my life as a farm worker in the 1960s. I could almost hear the lively Tejano music and the animated cries of Viva la Huelga and Viva Cesar Chavez. I could almost hear it, but only in my head. It was March 18, 1966, and I was at the small two-room office for the local farm workers organization where I worked after school. I was 15 years old and a freshman at Porterville High School, and I knew I was missing out on a momentous occasion. Just a few miles away, my father, Jesus Marin Barrera, and the local National Farm Workers Union members were waiting for the marchers, the peregrinos, to show up in Porterville. The peregrinos had left Delano the day before and were on their way to Sacramento, a march of more than 300 miles, which was designed to protest the plight of the farm workers and to bring national attention to the miserable working conditions. My father was a president of the local farm workers union, and they were at the entrance to the city, waiting for the marchers, the peregrinos, to arrive. The plan was to brazenly march down Main Street and go to a local park, Murray Park, where a rally would be held to be followed by each of the local union members taking home one or more of the peregrinos. Although my father had requested a parade permit, the city of Porterville had refused to issue it and had advised my father that anyone who marched would be arrested. So my father had strenuously forbade me from joining them. He did not want to see me in jail. I did not often disobey my father, but I knew that if I didn't disobey him this one time, I would regret it. I thought about it long and hard and then made the decision. I would join the peregrinos. I knew my father would eventually forgive me. Plus, I justified my decision by saying, what if my father needs me? So I left the office and joined the peregrinos as they entered Porterville. Oh, what a glorious event it was. My father played the accordion. My uncle, Jose Raul Barrera, played the guitar. And my other uncle, my mom's brother, Gilberto Garza, played the drums as we marched to the park where we had a rally. There was music, food, wonderful company, and many cries of Viva la Huelga, Viva la Causa, and Viva Cesar Chavez. That is one decision I have never regretted. Oh, and by the way, none of us were arrested. I guess the Porterville jail could not hold so many people. My name is Yolanda Barrera, and I grew up in Porterville, California, in the 1960s. I was a farm worker. We arrived in Porterville from Mission, Texas on March 5, 1961. My family came to Porterville because the factory where my parents worked in Mission, Texas closed down and they had no means of support. So we went to Porterville, where, according to rumors, work was plentiful. My parents became farm workers, picking various fruits. Basically, you name it, they picked it. Grapes, oranges, grapefruits, lemons, tomatoes, plums, apricots, pears, olives, and peaches. They earned a dollar an hour, which was the minimum wage, and they considered themselves very lucky to be able to work. When we arrived from Texas, there were five of us: my parents, my brother Marin, age 8, my sister Annie, age 5, and me, age 10. We lived in a one-room studio, which had only one bed. So my parents slept on the bed, and we slept on the floor. After we arrived, I saw my parents go out looking for work, and they would return home, saddened due to their inability to find work. I could see the worry lines deepening before me. A few days later, my siblings and I arrived home from school to find that our parents were not home. I was so excited because I knew that meant they had found a job. An hour later, they came home. My mother's beautiful face, which was always a translucent white, was covered with dirt, sweat, and pesticide residue. My mother's arms, which were always very elegant looking, long, thin, and beautiful, long nails, they were covered with scratches and caked blood. And all of her nails were broken and jagged. My father, the strong man whom I always looked up to, appeared stooped and looked exhausted, like I'd never seen him before. Things would become worse. Most of the work around Porterville was not hourly, it was piece rate. Piece rate is a system where the worker gets paid for the number of boxes he fills with fruit. The faster he works, the more money he'll earn. While this sounds, quote, fair, it is a ruthless system designed to tilt the scales in favor of the grower. The pay per box is so minimal that it is difficult to even achieve the minimum wage. Oftentimes, the worker drives himself unmercifully, even to the point of physical exhaustion, heat stroke, and injury. This system is also designed so that all family members must work for the family to survive. My parents did not know how to pick fruit, and after learning to do so, it was a very painful experience nonetheless. They had to learn to balance and carry a heavy wooden ladder on their shoulder as they walked from one set of trees to the other all day long. They had to learn where to place the ladder on the tree to maximize their ability to reach the oranges and not break any of the branches. Breaking branches meant they were fired. They had to fill a backpack type of bag worn in the front called a morral. The oranges could not be pulled from the trees. They had to be cut with special scissors, which the workers had to provide on their own. Pulling oranges would result in being fired. Each bin of oranges was paid at $5 a bin. At the end of the day, if my parents were lucky, they made a bin between both of them. That came out to considerably less than the minimum wage of $1 an hour. My parents quickly realized that they would not survive, and so the children had to help. Every weekend, every holiday, and all summer, we joined our parents in the fields. When other children at school would say, "Yay, it's Friday," and they looked forward to the weekend, we would groan inwardly because it meant we'd have to get up at 4:30 in the morning, drive to an orchard, and work all day. It was hard work with very little pay, but we had no choice. We had to be ready to start working as soon as the sun rose. We would all sit in the car at the orchard waiting. At first, I could not figure out why this was necessary. But I soon learned that it was first come, first serve. Once all the ladders were given out to the workers, all other prospective workers were sent home. No work for them. Each family was assigned a set, which is comprised of four or sometimes six orange trees. As the fruit of one set was picked, the family moved to the next set, which could be a block away, depending on the number of workers. The boxes were marked with a family name. The contractor would examine the set to make sure no oranges remained on the trees, and that the oranges in the boxes were not rotten, and to ensure that the oranges had not been pulled by hand rather than cut with the scissors. A breach of any of these meant the family would be fired. Working in the fields was painful and physically exhausting, and the pay was horrendously low. We barely survived. But the worst part was how we were treated and the lack of basic necessities. There was the constant threat of being fired. If we broke a branch, if we pulled the orange, if we left oranges in the trees, if we didn't keep up with the other workers, if we got there late, or if we left early. Generally, water was not even provided, but if it was, it was a barrel with only one rusted dipper, which everyone had to use. While we could take our own water, we had to keep carrying it along with the ladder, the morral, and our lunch. Plus, we'd quickly run out of water due to the heat of the unmerciful, blistering sun beating down on us. At times, we felt we were going to pass out. And the toilets? Well, there were none. We had to take our own toilet paper, and when the urge hit us, we had to run to a place in the orchard where someone could not see us and stoop and do our business. It was embarrassing and demeaning, and I felt subhuman. Sometimes tragic things happened in the fields. I'll never forget the day a little boy who lived next door to us was killed in the field. The driver of a tractor backed up with a bin of oranges and did not see the child. The poor child's head was crushed. No one could afford child care, so everyone took their children to work, even if they were too young to work. It was such a tragic death, and it affected us all very much. But working in the fields was not all bad. In fact, while it sounds dismal and depressing, it was also fun. We hated to work weekends, but on the other hand, all of our friends were working as well. So going to work meant seeing our friends. At times, we got really lucky, and we would get a set next to a friend, and while we picked oranges, we could talk to each other. Sometimes we got really lucky, and we got to pick oranges next to the cutest guy in the field. Then there was the song and laughter. While working in the fields, everyone sang, whether they were good at singing or not. I learned so many songs from working the field. People wouldn't just sing quietly. They would belt out the songs. Those who were really good singers would get requests from the others to sing certain songs, and people would sing along, although everyone kept working while they sang, of course. Plus, because the family worked together on the same set, we all became extremely close. We depended on each other. My dad would impose a quota of how many boxes we had to make before we could go home. Once we started getting close to that number, we would urge each other on. We learned very important lessons by working in the fields, including that working hard is necessary for the survival of a family, and that a family cannot survive without the help of each member. Even young children can help. My sister Annie was only 5 years old when she helped to pick oranges. She would pick up the oranges which were accidentally dropped in the middle of the tree, and she would put them in a box. Although we worked very hard and worked every chance we could, we still did not earn enough money on which to survive. So my parents decided we would be migrant farm workers and go to labor camps for the summer. Bernales and Yuba City. Bernales was a labor camp close to Modesto, California. We worked in the tomato harvesting machines and later picking apricots. On the tomato harvesting machines, we earned the incredible sum of $1.75 an hour. There were four of us who could work, my parents, my brother, age 13, and me, age 15. We worked 10 hours a day at $1.75 an hour. And thus, we earned an incredible $17.50 a day each, for a total of $70 a day as a family. We thought we'd be rich by the end of the summer. The work was extremely hard, because the machine would bring up the entire plant with the tomatoes. Seven workers would stand in a row facing a conveyor belt. And as a plant came up on the conveyor belt, our job was to get rid of the plant, the rocks, the dirt, the leaves, and any rotten tomatoes, and only allow the, quote, good tomatoes to make it to the end of the conveyor belt where they would drop to a bin. We would stand all day long, and it was back-breaking work. At the end of the workday, we were physically exhausted, and every muscle ached. We could barely walk. But when we got to the labor camp, suddenly the sight of everyone arriving from work would re-energize us. We found things to amuse us. We played baseball or chalupa. The younger kids played leapfrog. Teenagers like me listened to music on a small portable record player. The only record we had was Wooly Bully and Hang On Sloopy. So every day, that's what we listened and danced to. Every day was a day of fun, and I still have wonderful memories of those days. As my cousin Tony would say, we had, quote, clean fun. we felt good about being there, primarily because we knew we were helping our families to survive. From Bernales, we went to another labor camp in Yuba City to pick pears and later plums. It was very hard work, particularly picking pears, because we had to put double extensions on the ladders to be able to pick the pears on the trees. After a few hours, the ladders, which were generally wood, would begin to dig deep into our shoulder, and we would feel serious pain and then numbness. In Yuba City, my aunt's family joined us. We all lived in the same room, 14 in total. We would get up in the early morning hours before dawn, and all of us picked plums. We looked forward to Sunday when we went to church. We loved going to church because it was the only time we did not have to work. We were migrant farm workers for two summers, 1965 and 1966. And then my father decided to stay in Porterville permanently. That was the most boring summer ever. We had been looking forward to going to the labor camps. We'd been corresponding with our labor camp friends who came from Texas, Colorado, Arizona, and different parts of California, and we met up there. Instead, we stayed in Porterville and picked tomatoes. Right before school started, we started picking olives. By the time school started in September, our bodies would be a mess. Our knees would be black and blue from kneeling to pick the plums, and our hands and nails would be green and yellow from picking olives. I actually volunteered to wear dresses with a hem below my knees, the best way to hide my bruises. Then we'd start school and find out that our friends looked just as bad as we did. Because our family was a farm worker family, we had no money to spare. When school started, my mother would buy me five dresses, one for each day of the week, and one pair of shoes. That was it for the year. I had to take care of my clothes because there wouldn't be any others for another year. But being poor made us very creative. Because my parents picked tomatoes, the owner of the field allowed them to take home tomatoes for the family to eat. After a while, we'd have a lot of tomatoes sitting around the house. But believe me, none of them went to waste. I loved eating tomatoes, and I still do. The ice cream man used to come around our neighborhood every day with that tantalizing music announcing his presence. My brother, sister, and I did not have money to buy an ice cream bar. So one day I came up with a brilliant idea. I stopped the ice cream man and asked him if we could barter three tomatoes for each ice cream bar. After that, the ice cream man stopped at our house every day. And after tomatoes, we traded for oranges and then the fruit of the season. Being poor also brought out talents we didn't even know that we had. As I got older, I wanted to wear nicer clothes than those that my mom could afford to buy us. So I learned to sew. I became really good at it and was able to make clothes for myself and my sister. By the time I was in high school, I'd met a lot of college students who worked in Delano with Cesar Chavez. Before then, I'd never met a college person, and I'd always imagined that the college student would be very studious-looking and very boring. But I met students from UC Berkeley and other universities and colleges, and they were all so young, so talented, so amazing. They cared about La Causa, and they worked very hard to improve the lot of the farm workers. I decided that I also would go to college, and I would join the ranks of these amazing human beings. Before I could do so, I had to figure out how to go to college. So I went to my counselor, only to find out that he did not think I should go to college. He pointed to a series of obstacles as to why I shouldn't go to college. He said, "You know your parents don't have any money." I told him I'd heard there was financial aid available. His response was, "That is a lie. If there was something like that, don't you think I would know about it? When I insisted that I could go and work in college, he told me that he knew many fine Mexican-American youths who'd gone to college and gone crazy, and he cared too much about me to allow that to happen. He refused to give me any information about how to apply to college. He suggested I should become a cosmetologist. Now, this may sound very strange now because there are so many ways to find out about college now. Now everything is available online. In those days, however, there were no computers. Speaking to my counselor wasn't working. So I went to the library and obtained names and addresses of every politician who might be able to help me. I wrote to assemblymen, congressmen, and others. I thought that would work, but it didn't. They all sent me form letters thanking me for my interest in government. Finally, a college student told me to just write to any college and put down the city, and the letter would get to the admissions office. So I wrote to San Jose State, and lo and behold, it worked. I was only interested in attending San Jose State University because someone had told me it was a teacher's college, and at that time, I wanted to be a teacher. It came time to send the transcripts, and unfortunately, I needed my counselor's signature for that to happen. You guessed it. He refused to approve it. I was lost. I didn't know what to do. Finally, I went to the Dean of Women and told her what was going on. She was furious with my counselor, and she immediately signed the transcript request. Unfortunately, it was too late. I received a letter from San Jose State advising me that the transcripts were late, my file was incomplete, and I would not be accepted. I was beaten. I would have to become a cosmetologist after all. One day, however, I was at a union meeting and Cesar Chavez came up to me. Yes, came up to me, a nobody. And he told me that he had heard that I wanted to go to San Jose State, but I'd had problems with the transcripts and I would not be accepted. He told me that he could get me in if I wanted to go. If I wanted to go, I heard angels flying around me and I heard celestial music. Of course I wanted to go. I don't know what he did, but before I knew it, poof, I was admitted to San Jose State. After this negative experience, I wanted to make sure that others at my high school, particularly my siblings, did not run into the same obstacles. I spoke to the principal at my high school and suggested that we have a community meeting so that the high school could demonstrate to the community that it cared about them and their opinions. I promised him a huge contingent of community people. I could deliver this because I was very involved in community work at the time. Although I was only 17 years old, I was on the California Rural Legal Assistance Advisory Board. I was working as a community worker at Woodville Labor Camp. I was on the supervisory committee for the El Futuro Credit Union. I was on the board of the El Futuro, a civic organization. I was president of Los Camaradas, a youth group in the community. And I worked with the United Farm Workers. More importantly, my father, who was very involved with union activities, knew everyone in town. As a side note, you're probably wondering how I had so much time to be on so many boards. Well, that's what happens when you're not allowed to date. I joined these community organizations since I was 13, 14 years old. I always appeared older, and no one questioned my presence at these adult group meetings. In fact, I was usually called upon to be the individual to organize marches against City Hall or lead a protest. Many years later, when I went to law school, my father told some of his friends that I was attending law school, and the response was, "You mean she wasn't an attorney when she lived here?" Well, back to the meeting. I told the community members about what had happened. I told them that I had been an honor student all my life. I'd gotten 3 of the 4 awards given to graduating 6th graders at John J. Doyle Elementary School, and I'd received the prestigious Outstanding Student Award. At Pioneer Junior High, I was on student council, and I received the Outstanding Student Award. In high school, I worked 4 hours after school, all through high school, and I was on various boards, and yet I was still an A student. Further, I'd been selected as a girl state representative to represent my school in Sacramento. I related to them what my counselor had told me and how he had attempted to derail my plans to go to college, and I asked, if that happened to me, imagine what is happening to your children at that school. The community was in an uproar. After overcoming this major obstacle, I thought it would be smooth sailing, but it wasn't, not yet. I started to make plans to go to college, but then my father decided he didn't want me to go away to college. We had major fights. He valued education, but he didn't want me to leave home, so he wanted me to go to the local college, Porterville Junior College. I was confused because my father always stressed education. Although he had never attended school in the United States, my father constantly lectured us about the value of education. So I thought he would be thrilled that I would be going to college. He wasn't. His preoccupation was my reputation. What are people going to say? They will think you have gone away because you are pregnant. That's what he would tell me. I told him I didn't care what people thought, and his response was, "That's fine for you, but we care. We live in this town." Finally, he threatened me with the ultimate weapon in his arsenal. If you go away, I will disown you. I always thought only rich folks were disowned, and then I realized that he could do that to me. He could cut me off from my family. But I couldn't back down. I'd gone too far, and ultimately, I went to college. And ultimately, my father forgave me. It was September 1969, and I was going to college. I couldn't be happier. But the obstacle of going to college was nothing compared with staying in college. Because of my late admission, I was unable to obtain financial aid. Fortunately, I received some scholarships through my high school, so they paid for my tuition and my housing in the dorms. But halfway through the school year, I saw that I would not have enough money to make it through the year. I couldn't turn to my parents. Fortunately, I was able to get a job as a secretary in the EOP office. Thanks to that job, I was able to survive until the end of the school year. My younger siblings, Marina and Annie, also attended San Jose State. Yes, I talked them into it, and yes, I became their mentor. I wonder how differently my life would be today, but for the fortuity of having met Cesar Chavez and his intervention. I actually met Cesar Chavez through my father. My father, under the direction of Jim Drake from the Migrant Ministry, had started a farm worker organization to seek better living conditions for farm workers and better working conditions. I worked in the office, and we sold gas, oil, and tires to the members at incredibly low prices. Jim Drake had spoken to the farm workers organization and suggested that they speak to Cesar Chavez, who had a farm workers organization in Delano, and he was attempting to unionize workers seeking better working conditions. The Porterville group agreed to meet him. Cesar Chavez spoke to them, and the members unanimously agreed to join with the Delano group. The local group, however, would maintain its autonomy, and my father would continue to be the president of the local farmworkers organization. Slowly, our lives changed. We became more and more involved in union activities. When the Filipino and the Mexican farmworkers in Delano walked out of the Great Fields in 1965, we became particularly involved in the union activities. My parents worked picking fruit, and then in the afternoon, they traveled to Delano, about 30 miles distance from Porterville, and joined the picket line, urging the workers to walk out and to respect the union and not to be scabs. On the weekends and after school, our entire family, extended family and friends, all participated in the picket line in Delano, and later, the Boycott Grapes picket line in Porterville at the grocery stores which sold the scab grapes. We also hosted various fundraisers for the striker families who had walked out of the grape fields and now were suffering without any food, without any clothes, and not able to pay their rent. And then there were the Friday evening meetings at the Filipino Hall in Delano. My father organized car caravans to save on gas money, and we all piled into the cars and traveled to Delano to attend the meetings so we would know what was going on with the farm workers and so that we could turn in the money, the food, and clothing we collected for the strikers. At these meetings, often there were politicians who wanted to speak to the group. On some occasions, I interpreted at these meetings from English to Spanish and vice versa. I loved doing that, even though I had no training. I still remember editorializing when I translate, and the audience would burst out in laughter, and the politician who was speaking would look at me quizzically since he hadn't made a joke. I shrug and move on. Cesar Chavez himself personally asked me to translate. I felt so important. That's the kind of man that Cesar was. He was humble, and nothing was beneath him. He could speak to anyone, and that person felt special, felt as if the world had stopped for a split second. Many years later, in 1993, the world did stop for a split second, the day that Cesar died. After attending San Jose State University, I taught high school for a number of years and then attended UCLA School of Law. I have been a federal criminal defense attorney for 32 years. My brother, Marin, is a psychiatric technician supervisor at Porterville Developmental Center. My sister, Annie, is an account executive with AT&T. My youngest brother, Mario, is now an attorney with a Los Angeles County alternate defense. My oldest daughter, Veronica, attended USC School of Law and is now an attorney with the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. We all continue to heed our father's advice to help those who are worse off than we are. We all continue to participate in community events and donate our time, energy, effort, and money to worthwhile causes. My siblings and I remember the lessons we learned from my father, not the least of which is to always remember who we are and to be proud. Our parents taught us to be the best at what we did, regardless of what we were doing. They taught us that education and hard work will get you where you want to go. In doing the work I do and in giving of myself, I feel that I honor the memory of Cesar and my parents who struggled so hard to better our lives. To this day, when I cannot decide on a course or I have an ethical dilemma, I say to myself, what would my father do? Que viva la causa!